This is Profiles in Risk. Hosted by Nick Lamparelli. Every week, we interview those who risk life, limb, fortunes, career, and reputation. And those who work behind the scenes, who look to protect and enlighten us about risk. You can find the show notes and other insurance-related content at insnerds.com. That's insnerds.com. Now, on to the show.
Welcome to Profiles in Risk, the INS Nerds podcast. My name is Nick Lamparelli. Today I have a special guest. I will be speaking to Frank Sweeney, who's the co-founder and CEO of a company called OnRisk. Frank, how are you?
How are you, Nick?
I'm good, thanks. First question, what is OnRisk? What does OnRisk do, and how does it bring value to the insurance industry?
OnRisk is a digital platform for structuring high-value property and casualty risk. And it essentially takes a part of the industry that we term high-value risk, and it looks at the issue of how you take a high-value risk and shard it into smaller pieces in an efficient manner. So the idea is, if a risk is too large for one carrier to hold on to, how can you then efficiently, using the latest technology tools, how can you take that risk, break it into smaller pieces, and then essentially structure a transaction that allows you to seed off parts of that risk to a number of other carriers within the industry.
So what define high value? Like what kind of size risk are we looking at here?
Well, probably the best way to define it is whether the risk is generally traded as a one-off risk. So, I mean, obviously, if you're talking about an auto policy or a homeowner policy, other than a very large home, something on that order, typically, when somebody purchases a policy, they're going to go to a single carrier. In certain exceptional cases, the risk may be large enough that they would actually syndicate the risk. But those would be examples of one-off risk. A high-value risk is a risk that, by definition, a single carrier would view it as too large to assume or retain that entire risk. So a high-value risk might come about in one of two ways. It can either start as a high-value risk, right? So if British Air is going to go out and buy a new A380 jumbo jet, they're going to pay somewhere in the order of $433 million list price for each A380 they buy. All right, so that's obviously they'll get discounts and that sort of thing, but you're talking about an enormous risk right from the get-go. So they may have several hundred planes, 777s, A380s, 757, other types of aircraft. So, you know, some risk just starts out as a high-value risk. And there are, you know, those don't just have to be property risk, by the way, right? I mean, recently there was a $600 million cyber tower that was placed, which, as far as I know, is the largest cyber risk ever placed to date, although there may be some larger. But that's an enormous size risk, and it's very unlikely that a single carrier is going to want to hold onto that whole risk. The other way that you come up, that a high-value risk would come about, is it accumulates by way of a portfolio. So if I go back to the example of the homeowner policy or the auto policy, a company like a USAA or State Farm, they're writing tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions even of those risks. They're all going into a portfolio somewhere. And then that, by virtue of accumulation, that portfolio is obviously getting enormous in size. So what they're going to do is they're going to take that entire portfolio, and they're going to turn around and they're going to seed off a portion of that risk through what is traditionally called the reinsurance market. So in that case, they will trade that risk off on a per occurrence basis, which means, you know, for each individual storm that might happen or each individual earthquake. Or they may trade it off as an aggregate, which means that they look at, they would accumulate their aggregate losses over some period of time, and then take parts of that and seed that off. So high value risk is everywhere within the industry, but there's different pieces, or there's different submarkets that are dealing with these risks. So the aviation market would take care of my British Airways A380 example, whereas the reinsurance market, the traditional reinsurance market, would take care of the portfolios that USAA or State Farm are accumulating.
Okay, so let me play devil's advocate. So I'm trying to give the audience a sense of how complicated that is. But let me play devil's advocate. I'm British Airways. I'm the broker for British Airways. They buy a plane. Why do I need on risk? Why can't I just go to a bunch of carriers and just say, hey, 10 carriers, why don't you each take 10% of this, and we'll call it a day? Explain the complexity of trying to seed a portfolio or feed a high value risk to the market, and why on risk provides a high level of value or simplicity for that. Explain that process a little bit.
Okay, well, the key difference is that when British Air goes to the market, and there are obviously there are markets and the methods that we have in place now that within the confines of existing technology constraints do a good job of placing those risks now. But it's very challenging, because if I'm placing the British Air global program, or if I'm placing State Farm's property cap program, something like that, it gets very complicated very quickly, because again, I'm seeding the risk off to multiple carriers. And it's not just multiple carriers. I'm introducing a lot of other complexities in that transaction. So I'm bringing additional parties in, right? Because if I want to access the London market, I'm going to go to a London broker. If I want to access the Bermuda excess market, I'm going to get a wholesale reinsurance broker that knows the Bermuda market. So I've got new players coming in. I've got different currencies involved, right? I'm dealing sometimes with different languages. I'm dealing with different regulatory entities. So the Bermuda regulatory entity want to see certain things in their carriers. The London market has a certain way of operating, that sort of thing. So I'm not going to go through the whole list, but there's probably 10 or 15 different factors that just really don't exist when you're dealing with a one-off policy, where somebody's just going in saying, bind and click the policy, okay, now I'm on the coverage. It's, you know, for $1 million homeowner cover or whatever. So so right off the bat, when I place that risk, I've got a very complicated structuring problem that I've got to deal with, because I'm setting up what in the industry might be called sometimes a program or a tower, and then I'm going to begin to break that tower into pieces. So I might layer the tower. I might allocate shares within certain layers. I may syndicate part of the risk of the London market.
Yeah.
I may. So it gets... Placement-wise, it gets very complicated. The number of quotes I'm dealing with, I've got people quoting on different layers within the tower. I got different quotes coming in from different markets. I'm dealing with different placing brokers who are sending me quotes. Yeah.
And sorry to interrupt you, but some carriers specialize in certain layers, and other carriers specialize in other layers. So it's possible that it's not as easy as just prorating it across a bunch of carriers. If you're a smart broker, you're trying to optimize the purchase for the buyer, for the insurance buyer, by putting the right coverage with the right carrier. So it's possible that that tower becomes like a giant Lego tower, and the pieces are constantly shifting and moving around so that the broker and the buyer can optimize their insurance purchases. Am I right?
That's exactly right. And the buyer or the broker, typically it'd be a broker in the high value risk market, but they're going to have a kind of a holistic view of the tower, the program that they're working on. So they'll see the pieces moving back and forth, and they will be receiving, they'll know the appetites. They'll say, okay, AIG typically likes to play in this part of the tower. CNA likes to write a single, they want to write a whole layer because they don't want to deal with, they don't want anyone else on their layer. The Lloyd's market typically is going to want to syndicate. They're going to want four or five syndicates sharing the risk with her. So there are different kind of methods and practices and conventions in these different sub-markets around the world. The interesting thing is there's a little bit of an asymmetry of risk, because if I'm the broker, I have a pretty holistic view of the deal. But if I'm the underwriter, I may have very incomplete or only partial information on what's going on within that tower, right? Because I know the broker's coming to me and saying, I need you to bid on the 400KX, 100K layer. That's, I'm talking about thousands in that case. And so I'll be happy to respond to it, but I may not know anything else that's going on. I won't know who's participating in the lower layer. I probably won't know what's going on above me within the tower, who's taking the upper parts of the risk. And just to kind of finish off my answer on the why it's so complicated, it's like even after you bind the risk and you decide I want these 20 carriers, okay, and I want these layers, and I want these markets involved and that sort of thing, then I have to process everything else for the deal. So if I get 20 carriers, I have to send out 20 premium statements. If I get a claim, right, I have to bill 20 times, and then I have to wait for claim payments to come in from 20 different carriers, and I have to coordinate those. So I'll either wait until they all come in and then pay a large sum up back to the buyer, or I'll pay partially, but I have to track all that stuff. So historically, tracking, providing back office services for these kinds of complex deals has been a pretty significant task. It's one of the main things that, say, reinsurance brokers do, and a lot of wholesale brokers provide these kinds of transactional services and back office services for their clients. So the point is, there's a huge difference between, most of the industry consists of high volumes of one-off deals, right? But this part of the industry, it consists of a relatively small number of transactions that have huge value. So it's like everything flips around. It's like State Farm is writing many, many, many one-off policies. They turn around and they're going to market once a year for some mega property cat program. But the amounts of the risk are enormous. So it's a very interesting view of an industry than people tend to think of as, writing a large number of small policies. But in the back rooms, within these global carriers in particular, there are these huge risk transfers going on, involving very, very large scale risk.
Yeah, it reminds me of the days before in down on Wall Street, where trades would take place. Millions and millions of trades would take place on the New York Stock Exchange, and it was all processed hand by hand, and it would actually take days for these transactions to clear. And there were stories of these paper receipts with these transactions being stored in boxes, and the boxes being wheeled down Nassau, Wall Street, from one firm to another as they cleared them and moved the stock certificates back and forth. And then the computer industry came along and kind of simplified that process. And that's sort of the way I think of OnRisk. That's how you and I met. OnRisk does that piece of it. And so it sounds as though right now, Frank, I'm curious, how are those, without OnRisk, how are those transactions being processed? Are they literally being handled manually? Are they being shoehorned into an Excel spreadsheet? I'm curious as to the before and after, before OnRisk and after OnRisk, how much simplicity that your enterprise product brings to the market.
To basically take the first question, like, how's it being done now? Okay, so let's just focus on the placement side, right? Well, most of it's being done now using, Microsoft Office type tools. Okay, so obviously there are always going to be legal documents, and people are poring over legal documents, looking at long lists of sub limits and deductions and other sorts of things, and kind of imagining what the risk might look like in their mind. You can get pretty good at that over time. Other people are working on, if they're working on portfolios, right, they've got these spreadsheets with incredibly large numbers of rows, and they're pouring over spreadsheets, that sort of thing. Emails are being sent back and forth saying, you know, I need you to take a piece of this layer. You know, I'll be very happy if you do that for me because I'm having trouble getting to the satisfying the client's objectives. So there's emails going back and forth to put this all together. And, you know, and then a lot of times when if a broker is working on a deal and they're done, they really have the structure the way they think the client's going to want it, they'll put together what I've heard the term called mud map, which is some kind of a drawing or maybe an adapted spreadsheet or something like that, that kind of presents some kind of a visual portrait of what the tower looks like. So you can look at it and say, okay, Swiss Re has this part of it, Munich Re has that part of it. So that's kind of the way the process works right now. So it's, you know, I think it's got its limitations. I mean, look, I've encountered people who actually say that they call that process efficient. But most of the people I've talked to, most of the people I talk to say, oh yeah, there's a lot of room for improvement in that process, because every time I change one little piece, right, if I change this number in the spreadsheet, then I have to go back and change the legal document, and I've changed this, I've sent another email out. So it's kind of a seriatim transaction that gets put together. It could take a lot of time. You're limited sometimes, like the broker might have to have a clear view early on about how they want to structure the deal, so they don't have the flexibility to say, I'm going to pull this layer back and send it to Bermuda instead of to Lloyd's this time. Or I'm going to try to get AIG to write this whole layer so I don't have to put together this syndicated risk at the last minute or something. So maybe they have to take an earlier view and they're more constrained in kind of the kind of structured solutions they can put together and all. But, you know, so the proposition of on risk in the placement side of the house, which is important, is kind of twofold. And there's a part I haven't really addressed right now, which I will now. But first of all, it's saying, look, there really can be and there should be a commercial software package, product, or whatever, that can really assist in this process. Yes, it's complicated. Yes, it's confusing. Yes, it unfolds in a pell-mell manner a lot of times through, you know, very skilled brokers and all who are working on the problem. But it really does make sense to try to corral that placement process and move everything onto a single commercial software platform that allows the broker or the buyer, whoever's working on the deal, to really track everything, to see how many quotes they've got, who's quoting different layers, that sort of thing. So that's kind of proposition number one. In some ways, the more interesting proposition of on risk is to say, okay, we've got a whole series of, like, Microsoft Office-type tools that are being used right now, spreadsheets, and Word documents. Those are great. People are going to always be using spreadsheets for things and Word documents. But the what I call the risk design process can really work more effectively, more efficiently, if it's made into a graphical or visual process. So if I'm putting together a tower, then what we're doing is through an application we have called Jigsaw Tower, we are providing some representation of the actual tower that somebody's working on. So you can, you know, somebody can actually manipulate coverages, move coverages into the tower. They can click on a coverage, see what the rate online is for that coverage. Potentially, we can link different kinds of towers together. We can superimpose coverages as well, or set up side-by-side coverages. And so somebody working on it, it's got a very natural feel to it, and we're able to concentrate a lot of information on the screen in a very efficient and supportive way for the user. So that's really something that's very different. And, you know, we don't get a uniformly positive response to that. Some people say, oh, that's kind of a gimmick or something, because I could do that on a spreadsheet or a Word document. But the bet we're making is that, no, risk design is going to become primarily a graphical, you know, unless it just jumps completely to artificial intelligence, something like that. But it's going to be largely a graphical process, a visual process, and it's going to be a platform that's very supportive of the user. It's going to run algorithms behind the scenes. It is going to introduce artificial intelligence in a meaningful way in parts of the process where it makes sense. And Whereas a risk is now placed on using a spreadsheet or a Word document or emails, that sort of thing. It's going to be done, risk design is going to be done in a kind of a CAD style, is the analogy I draw. So like where 10, 15 years ago, architects are still doing hand drawings, now they all use 3D CAD rendering systems. Microchip designers are able to design chips. Product designers are doing everything now on computer systems. And the systems do a lot of the calculations for them, and it kind of frees them up to play around more and change and kind of work outside the box and change their assumptions and come up with better product designs. So I think the view we're taking is that risk design is a simpler, easier, and ultimately a more accurate process if people can actually see and visualize what it is they're working on. And that information is kind of being organized and presented in a very user-friendly format for them.
Well, I think you threw out some key words there, but it first, I think the linking this to what architects have always done and engineers, where it was always done by hand, all the drawings, and now everything is done by CAD. It's simpler, it allows you to make, think of for the audience sake, think of a hand drawing where you're trying to draw a building. One small change means you basically have to start over on the drawing. And anyone that's ever created a tower in an Excel spreadsheet knows exactly the problem with this is that after all of the formatting and everything goes, all the edits that you have to do, one small change isn't a small change. It affects other areas nearby, and you end up having to reformat everything that goes on in the spreadsheet. So that's a really interesting analogy. But I think you had mentioned AI on this, and that's where I think if trying to use AI to optimize, it can't be done on a spreadsheet. It can't be done on an office product. Like, you need an enterprise piece of software that's going to do the optimization. So for brokers that kind of poo-poo it and say, oh, well, I can just create the same tower in Excel spreadsheet, maybe, you do run into the problems of editing if you may have to make a small change. But I think more importantly, moving forward, you want to apply some level of machine learning or AI to it to optimize the tower to really get the best purchase and the most optimal and effective purchase of reinsurance, then it has to be in a more sophisticated piece of software.
I mean, absolutely. And let me add a couple other points. Number one, one of the responses I've got, even though we haven't talked about this, principally targeting kind of the buy side, but one of the responses I've gotten from underwriters, interesting, who've seen the platform, is that one of the things they like about it is that some of the structures, even if you're taking a structure that's placed once a year for a very large coverage, okay, can be very confusing. And people working on spreadsheets and Word documents can be looking at the same documents and have a very different understanding of what the risk is. And then and down the road, if there's claims on it, that then leads to complex coverage disputes and broken client relationships and other terrible things. Because two people had different opinions of what a sideways cover meant, or how the reinstatement actually worked, or whether this was a drop-down layer or not. So, being able to build a more common framework, not that this could be done, instantly on day one, but just saying, okay, this is how this structure works. You can see it and visualize it. This is how the claim would apply, this sort of thing. I think there's a huge advantage there by also providing more accuracy and more consistency between all the different parties involved in these deals. The other point is that sometimes, like, the reaction when we get pushback from somebody, it's very much a matter of being wedded to the annual renewal cycle. We haven't talked about this, but most of the reinsurance space in particular, they go to market once a year. So North American property cat market goes out on January 1st. Asia goes out on April 1st. And they're going to market once a year. And then there may be a little bit of tweaking during the calendar year if something major happens, but basically they're locked in to a position for a year. And now in some cases, multiple years, like some of the cat covers are taking advantage of pricing. They're going for, you know, 3 or 4 year contracts, or they're mimicking what the cat bond market does with longer terms, that sort of thing. So I think the other premise here is that if this market's going to move to what I would call dynamic on-demand reinsurance or high-value risk, which means that you kind of, A, have an understanding of where you are at any given time, and B, you have an ability to go in and change that position by saying, we're going to need another layer because we're burning through our aggregates pretty quickly now because of the hail storms and the convective storms in the south. You know, the idea that as this risk gets more dynamic and people are less satisfied and less willing to accept an annual renewal cycle, then I think the graphical and visual tools become even more powerful because then you just flip the screen on and go to the risk and say, okay, this is where we need the layer. Let's just put that out to market, as opposed to digging out all the spreadsheets and digging out the contract and then trying to, you know, kind of restructure the risk in your mind. Okay, well, this is how this worked, and so let's either modify this contract or we'll do a new contract or whatever. I think as the market becomes more dynamic, which it will inevitably, these kinds of tools are going to become that much more important.
Yeah, very interesting, Frank.
Yeah, the kind of static, the market's got a little bit static right now because it's complicated getting these things done. So when you're done, you're like, oh, thank God, that's done. You know, we could put this renewal year to bed, you know, and see you in November. I mean, I'll see you at some conferences or whatever, but basically I'll see you at Baden-Baden, Germany, in November, and then we'll start hashing out the terms for the next deal. Now, I don't think this kind of risk, we're talking about enormous risk that's being held by these carriers, and I don't think, you know, I think the technology is going to allow a much more dynamic treatment of that risk. And given the scale of the risk, which we talked about, I think the technology is going to lead us fairly quickly, you know, you can debate what that means, to a much more dynamic on-demand type of market, to change risk positions between the different market participants.
Frank, what's a typical like typical day like for you at OnRisk?
Well, we're a small startup, so the thing I have to be most concerned about is there are a number of functional areas where I need to be spending time. So I need to spend time. I need to be disciplined about spending time pursuing funding, for example, because one of the important things for me was in starting OnRisk and all was a view that if you want to compete effectively in the global software market, you need to be well funded. You need to have outside capital, and you need to have the working capital to innovate, to market, to drive all the different components of the business. So I need to spend, you know, I need to be disciplined about spending a certain amount of time every week, you know, working on funding, you know, sending out slide decks, talking to potential funding sources, that sort of thing. Then I need to devote time also to marketing. So, you know, lining up subscribers and trial subscribers, working to train people who are using our platform, that sort of thing. And then I need to allocate time to design and the technical side of the business, because if the design and the technical part doesn't work out, then none of the rest of this is going to work. Because we're making a bet, after all, that risk design should be a graphical and visual process, right? So there has to be enough meat on the bone for people to see that it's not going to stop, right? That it's not just like one little gadget or one little application like Jigsaw Tower, that in fact it's going to be able to handle all these complex relationships that people have, like reinstatements or sideways covers, drop-down covers, prior and following, enduring and benefiting relationships within programs. You know, we need to make sure that we flesh out all the potential of the applications that we've got. Terms and conditions is another one we're talking to a lot of people about, that sort of thing. So. And then finally, there's, you know, the worst stuff, administrative, like getting the corporate tax returns filed, getting the 1099s done, and all this sort of stuff. So I mean, some of that stuff I'm able to delegate. I'm working with other people on it, but you know, I need to be involved in all those different areas. So the thing that can be challenging sometimes is you can really feel like you're hitting your stride. Like I'm feeling like I'm making progress in marketing, but then I have to break off from that and go back to funding, because if I don't, then I'm not tending to that particular field. The weeds are going to start to grow, and I'm not going to be pursuing the leads and that sort of thing. So I think when you're working on a small startup, where you can't specialize as much as you like, you know, you need to kind of be disciplined about how you allocate your time. So I'm trying to work in all those different areas and push all those different things forward. And then that's the only time I'm going to feel good about the progress you're making. Otherwise, I'm going to be worried about something that hasn't been worked on in a while. So on any given day, I might be working in one of those different areas. I would tend to try not to spend a whole day on any one of those things. So I might split the day in half and say I'll do follow-up funding leads and chase funding sources in the morning, and then I'll come back and work on marketing in the afternoon, or take care of the tax returns or some filing, you know, trademark filing or something that's been neglected, and come back and work on that. So
Frank, what do you like best about being in insurance? And contrarily, what do you dislike about the insurance industry?
I wasn't always in insurance, but I've been in insurance now for over 20 years, and I worked.
That was going to be my next question, by the way. So do the best and the worst, and then I want to ask you what you did in your prior life.
Okay, so the best is I've really enjoyed the things that I've worked on. I've worked in mostly in like the reinsurance part of the industry, but also to some extent what people might call wholesale. Some people call it specialty insurance. And I've been able to travel and see the different markets at work. So I've seen Bermuda, I've been to Switzerland, I've been to London, I've seen how those markets operate and that sort of thing. And the thing I like about this part of the industry is I love the scale and the complexity of the industry. So it's maybe a little different from somebody who's an agent who's writing, you know, who's helping people with these one-off policies like homeowner and car, where they have personal relationships within the community that are really important to them, that sort of thing. I'm working in a part of the industry where the relationships are actually within the industry, right? They're B2B relationships, if you will. And I really like the scale. I like the complexity of the industry. I've liked seeing all these different markets at work, because like in the high value risk market, the markets come up with all these interesting solutions on how to manage this risk, and they're all a little different. So the Lloyd's Syndicate subscription market is a little different from the way the Bermuda Excess market works. It's different from the Global Aviation with its giant pools and the P&I clubs that handle marine. They're all different, but they're all trying to do this same thing, basically take big risks and shard them into smaller pieces. So I love to see all the different of the complexity, the fragmentation within the industry, how different people working in different places to solve different problems but with some similarities. And the thing I really like is you know, which I'm engaged in now, is trying to find simplicity from that complexity. So it's trying to figure out, okay, here's something that on its face seems really complex, but you can break it down this way, or you know, this terminology is confusing here, but if you understand the terminology, they're really talking about the same thing, but they're using two different terms to talk about it. So I get really absorbed in that, and I really enjoy that. The thing that's interesting now, I think, I think you have a much broader perspective on InsurTech because you're doing interviews. Like next week, you'll be doing an interview with somebody who's in a totally different part of the industry doing something very different.
Mm-hmm. True.
Fun. But the thing I think that's interesting for me more recently is like, okay, if you look at all the amazing things that are happening around us, they haven't maybe directly affected us, right? We haven't had a drone drop a package on our front porch yet. Okay. Are we, We haven't been able to climb into the back seat of a vehicle and have it drive us without a driver yet, okay? But these things are all coming. If you look at autonomous vehicles and smart buildings and drones and robots and all this other thing, I think it's really interesting to think about what is an equivalent technological shift amount to within the insurance industry. So if you say, okay, we're going to go from cars where we operate the cars to cars operating automatically, what is a corresponding technological shift within the insurance industry look like in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years? And more recently, I've gotten more absorbed in that. You know, what's the pace of tech? Because there's more, in the insurance industry, there more, tends to be more of a debate about whether or not the industry can be disrupted or not. And for me, it's more like, I take it more as a given it's going to be disrupted, but I don't necessarily, but I'm interested in like what form is the disruption going to take? What will risk management look like in 10 years or in 20 years, that sort of thing. So more recently I've gotten very interested in that question because, you know, even when you're doing a startup, right, you want to make sure you're not going to get outflanked. So like if I'm working on saying, okay, that people need to do risk design using a graphical platform, there might be other people who say, oh, no, this is just going to go straight to like a computer that's just going to make all the decisions for us. So, you know, fund me because I do artificial intelligence and machine learning. And I take a little bit of a different view because to me this the high value risk problem already has a huge amount of complexity. So I think it's got to be broken. You have to understand how people are making decisions more and how the risks are going to be placed more to the capital providers before you can then try to automate it or build in machine learning or AI, that sort of thing. So, but there's different views on that. And you want to make sure that you're not kind of undershooting the mark in terms of the way you know the kind of technology you're going to use or how you're proposing to bring technology to the industry.
Sure. That's a very interesting take. And I think our thoughts overlap a lot on that. Before we get into rank the risk, our game, what I wanted to do is just ask you one more question about, again, insurance, but your background. You're a veteran. You've been involved in the insurance industry for quite some time, but you didn't start out there. As a matter of fact, I believe that there's some politics involved in the background of your life. So before you got into insurance, talk about what you used to do.
Right. Well, I originally got after I finished college, I got professional training in law and engineering, and I initially worked as an environmental consultant and a policy analyst in like the early days of the environmental program. So I lived in Washington, and I worked on the clean water program and the hazardous waste program and Superfund, and these are terms that would be familiar to somebody who's familiar with the kind of federal environmental programs and all. So that was really interesting and fun because I didn't go like the traditional corporate lawyer route. I was really interested in these fields that were opening up that combined disciplines that I had, law and civil engineering in my case. So I did that. And then from that, I ended up doing like a 2-year stint on Capitol Hill, working on the Energy and Commerce Committee as committee staff, working on legislation. And then through that, I met Jim Florio, later became the New Jersey governor. He invited me to come up and be one of his assistant counsels in New Jersey. And I worked on, you know, principally on environmental matters. I had a piece of the environmental portfolio. But I also began to branch out more into energy policy and then public utility regulation, and then, you know, and pieces of environmental insurance. Like if there was an environmental insurance, like cleaning up underground storage tanks or something like that, then it would go into insurance areas. So that was kind of my first exposure to insurance. When mm-hmm. I left there, I co-founded another company called CADEX. So I'm hardly a serial entrepreneur, but I've been involved in a startup before. I co-founded CADEX with Frank Fortunato. And that was really interesting. Cadex is still out there. It's a good company. It provides a range of reinsurance services and other services and that sort of thing for reinsurance brokers and carriers within the industry. But then I went through an interesting transformation. That Cadex started as a risk trading exchange in the pre-internet days, if you can believe that. And then we went through the internet bubble. We survived that somehow, and we kind of morphed into an IT practice because some of our clients said to us, well, you know, we're not as invested in this risk trading exchange thing, but we like the technology. Can you help us to develop an internet strategy? So we were able to take them and get moved some of them onto the internet. And then, you know, in the 2000s, we built kind of a whole IT practice in the reinsurance and the wholesale space. And so, you know, I have a pretty strong domain expertise just by virtue, I guess, of being in it for a significant length of time and studying and being a relatively pedantic person, being interested in, like, the details and the nitty-gritty of what I was looking at. I could never look at a spreadsheet and not try to understand what was on it and what the data elements were, that sort of thing. So I got a really good training in insurance IT and software IT, how procurement works. And of course, a lot of these things are things I'm trying to find ways around now. So, like, if you look at procurement, it tends to be very slow and time-consuming and expensive in this sector, right? Because they go through a whole system and come up with a whole set of specs. And it can sometimes take a year or two for a company to decide on a platform. And then they have to install it and deploy it and finish it. So that's like another 2 years. And, you know, 4 years in this day and age, that's like a ticket to obsolescence if you're not careful. I mean, the technology is changing so rapidly.
That's true.
Now with Onrisk, I'm trying to find ways to, we're trying to find ways to short circuit some of that by just allowing people to come on it as trial subscribers. See, you know, if they like it, then we can talk about a license. If they don't, they can just turn it off and go on to something else. And I'm a big believer in that. Because I think anything that gets that cuts some of those marketing costs and gets technology in front of people, the better. So.
Yeah. Any interest in getting back into government at any stage?
At this stage?
At any stage?
Not really. I mean, when you're working on a startup, you have to be kind of pretty dedicated, pretty consumed with what's directly in front of you. So I'm not opposed to public service. I think it's great. I think you need to, I think people should pick their spots. I think they should be able to move in and out. I think it's something that you want to do on your terms, so that if for some reason you are not satisfied with your experience, you can jump back to something in the private sector. And I think if you can do it on your terms, I think it's a tremendous thing. So I'm not really discouraging anybody. I think it's great. And I'm glad I did it. I have no regrets.
Good.
Yeah, I mean, there might be a circumstance in the future where I would entertain that, but certainly nothing at this point.
So, Frank, I want to thank you for being on the show, and I can't let you leave without playing a quick game of Rank the Risk, which, as you know, is a series of questions where I ask my guests or my co-host to rank the risks from most severe to less severe, and there's always a wrinkle here and there, but in your honor, I'm going to focus my questions on the reinsurance industry.
Can you speak slowly so that I have time to type words into the internet, into Google?
No, let's see if you can optimize your brain to answer these questions.
Okay,
so these are reinsurance-based. I want you to rank the reinsurers based on U.S., United States premium volume. So I think everyone knows the big players globally. But let's focus on reinsurers that get their premium from the United States. Four reinsurers.
Just a U.S. Just, premium?
Just U.S. premium.
All
right. So I want you to rank these from most premium to less premium.
Okay.
We got Swiss Re, Transatlantic Re, National Indemnity, which is Berkshire Hathaway,
right,
and Munich Re. So rank the reinsurers based on U.S. premium volume. Swiss Re, Transatlantic Re, National Indemnity, and Munich Re. So what's number one, Frank?
Is this your easiest question or your hardest question? I'm trying to
I don't know.
Difficulty.
I don't know. We'll see.
Okay, well, okay. Okay, this is a little bit of a trick question because, I mean, globally this would be a relatively easy question. So you've obviously made it a United States question in order to make it more tricky.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, so, Munich Re would be the Munich Re America operation in Princeton. National Indemnity.
You're ranking them one.
I don't know yet. National Indemnity is Gen Re, so it picks up them. I'm trying to show you that even though I'm going to get everything completely wrong.
It doesn't matter. I would play the Jeopardy music. I would play the Jeopardy music, but I'm dialed in, so I can't actually play it. But there is a time limit here, Frank. So just
okay,
rattle them off. Which one's number one?
Okay, so I'm going to say I'll say National Indemnity 1, Swiss Re 2, Munich Re America 3, Transatlantic 4.
Very close. Very close. National Indemnity is 1 by far. 2 is Munich Re. 3 is Swiss Re. And 4 is Transatlantic Re. So while Munich and Swiss dominate on the global scene, here in the United States, Uncle Warren controls the United States reinsurance market.
Okay, well, I just made somebody angry at Munich Re.
And Munich and Swiss are really close.
Okay,
Question two. So rank the countries, rank these countries by percentage of U.S. premium ceded. So U.S. premium, when it does get ceded out, goes to entities in different countries. So I want you to rank the following countries from most U.S. premium volume ceded to less.
Okay.
The U.K., Switzerland, Bermuda, and Germany.
Okay.
So out of the U.K., Switzerland, Bermuda, and Germany, which of those countries gets the most ceded U.S. premium volume?
Wow. These are good questions. Can I compliment the question? Do.
My off-pitch Jeopardy rendition. So U.K., Switzerland, Bermuda, Germany. Okay, Frank. Which one? Right. Which one's number one?
Okay. I'm gonna say Germany 1, Bermuda 2, UK 3, Switzerland 4.
Okay. You were a bit off, a bit scattered here. Number one is Bermuda. So outside of the U.S. with Berkshire Hathaway, when premium does get ceded globally, it goes to Bermuda number one, mm-hmm. Switzerland number two, mm-hmm. Germany three, and then all of the syndicates in London, UK four.
Okay. So I was close.
You're close.
And you're being kind. Okay. All right.
Two more questions.
Go ahead.
Okay, we went from companies to countries. Now we're going to go to perils. Rank these perils by proportion of global average total insured losses. Insured losses. So out of as claims make their way through the chain and they ultimately end up at the reinsurer, which perils basically have are being ceded the most? Tropical cyclone, earthquake, flood, fire. So globally, global claims rank the risks from most severe, most amount of claims paid to less.
Okay, that's in terms of total dollars, right? Total insured dollars.
Yes, yes, claims. So right, tropical cyclone, earthquake, flood, fire.
All right, so I'll say fire just because it's common to every place. I will say tropical storm next because it's so heavily insured. I would say flood third because it's insured in many parts of the world, not in the U.S., it's federal. You're not talking about federal programs, I assume, here. And then earthquake fourth because it's underinsured.
Okay.
What?
Tropical.
What
did you say? So this is insured loss. You didn't do well on this one, Frank. and this was a and I did this on purpose. I guess when guests come on, I should treat them well and just give them softballs.
No, you can treat
for some for some reason I like to throw curveballs on every single question and make them difficult. Okay, and this one's the curveball because I kind of want to make a point here. So global insured losses. Tropical cyclone is number one, and wind is generally covered everywhere. So tropical cyclone, then earthquake. So outside of the U.S., I think earthquake is a I wouldn't say standard peril, but the take-up rate's a lot higher. Same with flood. Flood is third, and that's my curveball, because when I saw this, I thought fire would be much higher. I thought it would be wind and fire, one and two, and then earthquake and flood in some order, three or four. But fire is not catastrophic generally. So yeah, there are some big individual claims, but they don't seem to aggregate up like the other catastrophic perils.
Are you talking about cat risk? Or are you talking about all risks? So are you counting like a homeowner?
All. Okay. Total average. I know. I was very surprised at that. So,
but you're also willing to own up to the fact that you got it wrong, also, right?
Yes, completely. and percentage wise,
I gotta drag you down a little. That's my last defense.
So, tropical cyclone at 30%, earthquake at 17%. Then there's a big drop off. Floods at 4%, fires at 3%. Global average.
Okay. What are the other big ones? They aren't on your list.
I don't remember. I'll throw the link up on the show notes so people can see those.
Yeah.
What's that?
That's only like 50% of the total.
Oh, there's a lot more, yeah.
Like mold?
I don't know. There's probably casualty.
Oh, casualty.
In there. Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, life probably. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. One final question, and kick you off the hook here. All right. It's the same question, except instead of global average claims paid, this is just global average insurable loss. This is just global average damage before an insurance check is ever written. So we still have tropical cyclone, earthquake, flood, and fire. And
so this is economic loss.
This is total. Yes, this is total economic damage, insurable economic damage. So tropical cyclone, earthquake, flood, and fire. And I'm going to give you a little hint. The order has changed a bit. Go.
Okay, so so fire is going to stay at the bottom probably.
What's one? What's the most severe global average claims producer.
All right, so I'm going to say I'm going to say flood 1, earthquake 2, tropical cyclone 3, and fire 4.
Pretty close. Pretty close. Earthquake is 1.
Okay.
Again, that surprised me. I thought flood would be 1. But for all the flood naysayers that are listening to this podcast,
I thought about putting flood 1.
Flood is endemic. It can happen anywhere, but it's not the natural catastrophe that people think it is. So earthquake is 1. Tropical cyclone is number 2. Then flood, then fire. And the numbers are really grouped together. So earthquake jumps from insured to not to total damage. Earthquake jumps from 17% of the total to 32% of the total. So essentially doubles. Mm-hmm. That's how severe that event is.
Is this a particular year or over 10 years, or what time period are we talking about?
I don't have the link in front of me. I'll throw that up on the show notes. It's many, many years. So this isn't where one event is really driving it. This is many, many years.
No, I understand.
Tropical cyclones 2, flood is 3, fire is 4. So for total economic damage, it's earthquake at 32%. Tropical cyclone at 22%. Flood jumps from 4% insured to 17% of the total damage. So it is a severe peril. And fire dropped from 3% of the total insured to 1% of the total damage.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to make that mistake twice.
Yeah, so you got that right. I would have gotten that wrong as well. I don't know what I was thinking. So, Frank, thanks for playing Rank the Risk. And before we let you go and end the show, we end every show on a positive note, or we try to. So I want to ask you for this particular week or recently, can you tell the audience something that happened to you that has made you very happy or proud?
Yeah, well, I have right now I have kind of a simple view of life because I fractured my ankles several weeks back and I've been recovering since then. And so for me, I'm happy when, a few days ago, I'm kind of in recuperation mode. I've got a boot on and it kind of slows me down, makes it difficult to move around. But it's nice to, when you have a feeling that you're coming back, you're mending from something like that. So I've had a feeling the last few days that that my ankle's doing better, and I'm hoping to see the doctor soon and start therapy and get better again. So these are things we take for granted in life. I'm more aware of them and more empathetic than I've ever been. And so for me, those simple things really matter a lot right now. So I'm able to get my work done, but it's harder and slower to get things done, and feeling that kind of recovery take hold is really it's really a good feeling. So
that's great, Frank. That's great. Yeah.
Thank you.
On my end, last night was my daughter's senior prom, so I'm very proud of her and the woman that she's become. It was interesting to see her and all her friends that I've known since they were little, you know, riding their bikes and playing chalk on the sidewalks, become these fabulous women, and in a couple months going off to college.
Where's she going to school?
She's going to go to California State San Marcos.
Awesome.
So very, very, very proud. Study international business, and maybe somehow I can get her into the insurance industry.
Well, let's hope this podcast and all the other ones that you do can play a role in that.
Yeah, when I play her the podcast, she likes the intro music, but as soon as I start talking, she rolls her eyes. So she's at that age. It's quite funny. So I don't shut it off. I keep playing it. I make her sit and listen to it. So
don't ever ask her what she really thinks of insurance. That's my advice.
I don't think she knows what insurance is, except it's something she has to have so that she can drive her car.
Okay, fair enough.
Frank, how can people get a hold of you if they'd like to reach out?
They can probably best thing to do is, well, first of all, they can always approach me on LinkedIn, which I think is a great tool. And I think they can certainly send me an email at fsweeney, S-W-E-E-N-E-Y, at onris.com. And if they go to the website, you'll see my contact information there. And I'd love to hear from people. It's an interesting space. I think our approach is interesting. I'd love to get feedback from people. And I really appreciate, Nick, you taking the time to do this interview and give me a chance to express myself via the Inns Nerd podcast that you do, which is terrific.
Thanks, Frank. I appreciate it as well. Thanks for coming on. My guest this week has been Frank Sweeney, CEO and co-founder of OnRisk. Frank, I'll see you soon.
All right. You take care.
Thanks, everyone.